Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Henrik Palmgren from Sweden, and this is Red Ice Radio. Wherever you're located, thank you for tuning in today. It is nice to be able to speak to you. We do three shows a week. Every other week, one of these is Radio 314 with Lana Loktev. We talk about many topics with a lot of different people who do research on many of the subjects that we are interested in learning more about. You might not agree with all our guests, and neither do we, by the way, but the intention here is to learn and discuss matters that are plagued by censorship, cover-up, and suppression in an open and investigative way so that we can determine validity and find out on our own instead of letting the media pundits decide what we can or can't talk about. We hope that you appreciate our search for the truth as we think different and dive into exciting research and material. Some get the value of that and others do not, but our primary interest here is truth and knowing. We do not shy away from controversial subjects, and we enjoy to break new ground into new areas and question sacred cows and some of the issues that people run far and wide to avoid. Take a look at redicecreations.com for radio shows, news, videos, links, and resources. You also have rediceradio.net for the radio archive. And of course, rediceMembers.com for our subscribers. We have Dr. Kevin McDonald with us. He is an evolutionary psychologist and was a professor at California State University, Long Beach. He is the author of about 7 books and over 100 scholarly monographs. His trilogy, The Culture of Critique, is an examination of Judaism as a group evolutionary strategy. He is behind the OccidentalObserver.net, where he writes and publishes some excellent articles on the Occident, the West, and topics of white interests. He is a brave academic who has managed to bring a different view, diversity, if you will, to an environment that is hypermanaged and controlled when it comes to the lack of political and ideological differences. We are going to begin our program today by refuting the Khazar theory of Arthur Koestler and rethink the background to the story, as this has caught on like wildfire among alternative researchers when it comes to discussing Israel and Judaism. Later, we'll talk about the reality of race, DNA studies, Semites and Europeans, pro-white interests, and independence, self-determination, and of course the moral cause of preserving identity among any people. We talk about the taboo of discussing immigration into Sweden versus Norway. We're also going to talk about Israel's war on the Palestinians. A lot ahead. Stay tuned. And welcome back, Kevin McDonald. Nice to hear from you again. Thank you for being here. It's a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for taking the time being here today, Kevin.
It's great to be here once again.
Excellent. Well, Professor, it's always very interesting having you here. Last time you were on, we focused quite a bit on Europe. Last segment here we did. And today I want to kind of zoom out a bit and look a bit more at the bigger picture of your work on, of course, group evolutionary strategy, as you write about in your book, The Culture of Critique. But, you know, one thing we could begin on here perhaps is last few times we've touched upon some of these topics, some of these themes. The issue of biology and race is, of course, central to this. It's come up quite a bit, but there seems to be a lot of conflicting information, shall we say, in regards to what, or maybe who is a better term, who is Jewish. I think a lot of this comes from the material of the likes of Arthur Koestler, who wrote The 13th Tribe, but we also have people like Shlomo Sand, who wrote The Invention of the Jewish Race. And I wanted to hear from your perspective. You can tell us what you think about this question, you know, the Khazar theory and what this has done to the debate overall. Do you think that there is a political objective behind of some of these works in order to kind of steered the debate away from the core issue, Kevin?
Well, it's an interesting topic. I can't tell you how many emails I've gotten over the years by people championing the Khazar theory. There seems to be something about it that attracts a certain kind of person. I mean, it's always been used for political purposes. Shlomo Sand is no exception. And he takes this view that Judaism is nothing but a cultural construct. So he doesn't want to have the idea that there's some kind of genetic basis to the Jewish community. There's exactly one study that I think is very flawed. I talked to my resident expert on population genetics suggesting that there could be a Khazar component, Ashkenazi Jewry. But in general, the studies are pretty unanimous in support in rejecting that hypothesis. So yeah, you've got one study on one side, and you've got, you know, dozens of studies on the other that don't find support for that. So I'm inclined to think that there's no empirical basis for that. The most recent studies are interesting, and again, all these things can be changed. But the most recent studies, two at least, show that or suggest that the Jewish males with the Middle Eastern genetic ancestry came to Europe and intermarried with European females, probably prior to, say, 1000 AD.
Wow, really? That far back, huh?
That far back. Wow. But it could have been somewhat later, but probably what most likely that happened in Roman times in the Italian peninsula. It's not really known for sure, but the point is that these studies do not contradict the idea that there is some important commonality among Jewish groups from a biological standpoint. Again, the KSAR hypothesis, there's something about it that appeals to a certain kind of person. They don't want to think that Ashkenazi Jews have any kind of Middle Eastern connection. And I don't entirely understand the psychology behind it, to tell you the truth.
Interesting. Now, do you think it's kind of rooted in a more, I guess, international perspective? It seems to me that this is kind of done in effect to kind of not break down only the conception of specific races, but really of all. It kind of goes hand in hand with a lot of the science and the data that's coming out of, you know, the Bayesian kind of theories and all that it's there as a measure to kind of destroy all the differences that we actually can perceive between the different races. So it's not really, in my view, directed perhaps in one direction. It's more to kind of legitimize the idea that it's, well, you know, it's not, no such thing really exists anyway, so let's just kind of drop the question, right?
Oh, I do think that's a prominent part of it. I think Shlomo Sand is probably an example of that, where you basically don't believe in any kind of biological reality to race, and so that's just another thing that you use in that kind of argument. But yes, you know, it's obvious that the whole idea of race has been incredibly politicized by the left, as you say, the Bayesian perspective that's still very much with us, and now probably dominates many departments of anthropology, especially cultural anthropology, because I don't know how you can be a physical anthropologist these days when you read scientific papers and they talk about markers for different races all the time. I mean, it's absolutely routine. You know, it's definitely very, you know, very much politicized.
Oh, definitely, exactly. And can you tell us a bit more about this? There was a recent article you posted there on the OccidentalObserver.net talking about the you know, exponential growth of Ashkenazi Jews following the medieval population bottleneck. That was the title of the article, and it shows this, what you just kind of briefly mentioned here. So does that kind of upset the whole idea of that it's a distinct difference in terms of DNA when it comes to the Jewish population? Is it very intermingled with the European one, or how do we deconstruct that, Kevin?
Well, that recent study is one of those studies that is consistent with the idea of a very substantial European input into the Jewish Ashkenazi Jewish gene pool. But it also shows how successful Jewish populations have been. You know, the word exponential growth. I mean, you've had very, very rapid population growth by the Jewish population, starting from a small bottleneck. You know, in other words, it started with a small group of people, which explains why there's so many. There are quite a few, diseases. That are related to, that are in that community, related to the genes. And so that happens when you have a small bottleneck population. They tend to be essentially interbreeding with each other. So these people are very closely related to each other. And it's another aspect of the biological aspect of things, is that when you have a small bottleneck, all the people in that bottleneck are going to be very closely related, and their descendants are going to be. So it certainly doesn't detract from the idea that this can be seen as an evolutionary strategy, that there are genetic implications. And it also shows that European Jewish populations have been very successful. That is, in fact, in some years in the 19th century, they were the of all European populations. And at that time, European population was growing very rapidly. The Jewish populations were growing the most rapidly of all. So it shows that they have been very successful.
So is it, do you think we can presume that there's been a population movement from the West to the East, as there was, you know, expulsions and things like that in Europe? And is it therefore that which kind of helps to discredit the Khazar theory? I can't remember off the top of my head how far back where they kind of they central that in the timeline, if you will, from when the Khazars allegedly, you know, started going into Europe or further west and north. But if there is such a thing as they share more European DNA and they moved slowly towards the east, then that's a complete contradiction right there, correct?
Yeah, I mean, the standard account, which I accept, is that Jews spread out within the Roman Empire on these trading routes up to Germany and so on. And they spread out from there, very small populations. But then, if we accept this recent study, especially when they got into Eastern Europe, they really started expanding demographically and became a major force and one of the larger, the Jewish population in Poland and Russia was quite substantial. Especially in the Pale of Settlement, and they were expanding very dramatically. I mean, at that time, these Jewish groups were very orthodox, and they put a great emphasis on fertility, and was independent of poverty. I mean, you had a lot of very poor Jews there, and they would still have huge numbers of children, and that this was part of this religious thrust, but it was also very much a sort of will to power, a will to demographic power. And these people, dominated the economies in Eastern Europe and the Pale of Settlement, but they just kept expanding demographically. And then they started to emigrate out of there into Germany, into the United States, into England and Western Europe. So that was the basic Jewish population history, I guess, of the last several centuries.
Well, that's interesting then, if we look at Judaic law and whatnot, in terms of this is supposed to be a matriarchal line, right? It's passed down through the mother. But if it's true that we have primarily Jewish fathers and European mothers or women in this case, how is that view, do you think, from a kind of a rabbinical point of view? Is this then, are they not truly Jewish, or what goes on there, do you think?
Well, I think that they are, because when it started, they just declared that they were Jewish. And I think that the rule that Jewish descent comes through the maternal line, it's basically a tactic so that if they marry their daughters out of the religion, which has happened historically, wealthy Jews oftentimes married their daughters to the kings and not necessarily kings, but the aristocracy of Europe,
yep,
and other wealthy families and so on, and so they would gradually have a sort of genetic representation in the non-Jewish population. But these people were not, technically considered Jews. It's a very interesting phenomenon. They would not do that with their sons. Their daughters would be married out, and oftentimes with very large dowries, to these other families.
Interesting. So what do you think is going on today then with DNA studies and everything else, that, the potentiality of maybe they're looking kind of for a more pure line? What would that be in your view? Would it be Semitic? What would be some of the markers they would be looking for here, if it's true that we can distinction the Jewish people as a unique or as a standalone race? What do you think?
Well, these recent studies show that there is a substantial Middle Eastern component, coming from the male line, basically, it looks like. Which is then connected to the rest of the Jewish population around the world. Some Jewish groups have remained more Middle Eastern than others, obviously, particularly the ones that didn't move out of the Middle East. I mean, you've got Jewish populations in Iraq, say Iran, that goes back, a couple thousand years, probably from the beginning of the diaspora, and they basically remained separate. I mean, that's the whole thing about Jewish social structures, to remain separate from the non-Jewish population and to not have intermarriage. But there are actually other examples of Jewish males going around and marrying local females and then setting up the barriers. or at least, you know, starting a separate group. It happened in Africa, where you had these Jewish traders. They went down and they intermarried with Africans. That's called the Lemda group. So there's these splinter groups, but in the case of the Ashkenazis, they became actually the most important Jewish group by far in terms of political power, financial acumen, and everything else. So that's basically the story that I, as I understand it.
Interesting. Now, are you talking about the Beta Israelites? They have a prominent Jewish population, I believe, in Ethiopia, and there have been a number of recent articles as well showing the difficulties here, right? Because there is a lot of racism in Israel, and the black Jewish population have been treated very poorly. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I think Jews in Israel are sort of being hung by their own petards. There, they, on the one hand, they really don't want this Ethiopian group. When they did come, they administered birth, you know, long lasting birth control to them. As you say, there's a lot of discrimination within Israel against them. But at the same time, you know, since they have this self-identity as Jewish and they can trace the, you know, this back and so on, they can't very well say that they're not Jewish at all. And so they have to maintain that they are. And so they have allowed this immigration. And I recall that they have used these Ethiopian Jews as a sort of exemplar of why Israel and Judaism itself is not racist, because, you know, they are part of the Jewish people and so on. But again, that's not really the whole story by any means. They are not considered really at the same level within Israeli society. And they've done things to sort of lower their fertility rate and so on. They do not want to be overwhelmed by these people.
Interesting. Well, we hear a lot about this. I remember another article a while back, but I think it was the Israeli government actually was involved in quite openly exporting African illegal immigrants to Sweden. Actually, they were actually paying each immigrant about $3,500 each to leave Israel and then go and set up permanent resident in Sweden. Obviously, what we're getting at here is the immense double standards of one aspect applies to to Europe, the West, and another standard applies to Israel. So that it's important, I think, to keep kind of hammering away at these double standards and the way that we are perceived to have one application of things on our end and a different for Israel, correct?
That is absolutely right. I keep repeating it on Actual Observer and elsewhere, because it can't be emphasized too often that Israel sees itself as a Jewish state. These diaspora Jews support Israel as a Jewish state, and that means you can't have African immigration. And so Israel has been exporting these immigrants, and some to Sweden, but quite often they've just simply repatriated them to Africa. They built a huge wall. They have holding areas, kind of, you might call them, you know, prisons, as it were, concentration camps, where these people are gathered together, and then they are dispersed back to their native countries. So that is something that if an American says that, or a Swede says that you know, Sweden should be free of immigrants, because you're going to lose your sense of being Swedish, you're going to lose the idea of a Swedish culture and the sort of homogeneous society that you have. Well, that's considered absolutely horrible in Sweden.
And absolutely, yeah.
You're going to suffer all kinds of opprobrium as a result of it. Same in America. And these Jewish organizations and Jewish-funded organizations like the Southern Poverty Law Center are going to be the first to go after you. And they're the ones that are really policing this. But so there's a huge double standard there. And what we're saying is that, you know, every people should be able to have its own place and determine its own destiny. And that means Africa for Africans and Israel for Jews, but, you know, Europe for Europeans and Sweden for Swedes.
Right. Yeah. Well, I agree. And I notice that this is also kind of a double standard here. There's some confusion here because ultimately, despite the unique situation, I guess that's one thing we have to circle a bit here in terms of Israel, because it's a recently founded nation, and the question of course goes back to, okay, what is their, you know, claim to this land? Is it, you know, biblical? Is it actually based in reality? Are there archaeological finds here and all that? Because on one hand, I think that, just as you say, everyone should have the right to preserve their heritage and their culture and their identity and their people being as they are and whatnot. So in that regard, I can see the double standard in critiquing Israel, but at the same time, obviously, looking at their recent aggressions on the Palestinians and what has happened in Gaza and all that. It's a quite unique situation, though, isn't it?
It's a very unique situation. And what's happened in Gaza is just another example where there's a sort of Israeli exceptionalism. If another country treated a group like Israel treats the Palestinians, there would be no end of international outrage and sanctions and all that. But because Israel has this strong connection with the United States, diplomatically, the United States thwarts any attempts in the United Nations to do anything. The United States keeps arming them. There's going to be no end to it. Actually, there's another very interesting recent phenomenon where the Israeli Supreme Court actually okayed laws within Israel that let these various Jewish communities exclude non-Jews from the community as being socially different or undesirable. So they can get rid of Palestinians from their community and get a sort of homogeneous Jewish community. Wow. Again, that kind of law is just anathema in the United States. Jewish organizations were on the forefront of breaking down those kinds of laws that did exist in this country 50, 60 years ago. But in Israel, now we see that happening. And again, it's just another example that Jews have a strong sense of wanting to be among other Jews. And they want to enforce that within Israel. But then in the diaspora, they want to break down those kinds of laws because they're, essentially they oppose the interests of the majority population.
Very interesting. Now, do you think that there has been an effort to try to, in recent times, considering, what's happening in Israel and everything, actually get more Jews back to Israel as an effort to, not repopulate, really, it's the wrong word, but to try to, we've seen the rise of, at least in the mainstream media, they're calling it, anti-Semitism and all this, but they're I think, a reality of the situation where we have a lot of the Muslim population, actually, in Europe that have lashed out. I know in France, this was a recent thing that bloomed out. Same thing in Sweden, specifically in Malmö, in southern Sweden, where we've had the majority of the Muslim population, that the Jews in these areas are feeling unsafe. They feel that they're being targeted and threatened in different ways. And my question and follow-through thinking here was, okay, maybe there is an attempt here to try to get also more of the Jewish population back to Israel. Is this something that is a kind of a part of the strategy, do you think, or is there an interest in preserving having a presence in the European countries, Kevin?
Yes, I do think that there's been a long tradition within Israel of encouraging Jews in the diaspora to come to Israel, and that may have been that may have increased lately because of the anti-Semitism in Europe. In France, I read a number of articles on France where Jews are being attacked in the street. They're being called names and this and that. But the reality is that this just really applies to sort of average level Jews, people who are not really rich and so on. I don't think it's going to change Jewish influence in the diaspora. That is, say within France, you don't see, really extremely wealthy Jews, the Jews that are very influential in the media and in the government. These people are not leaving. Jewish influence never depends on how many Jews there are in the country. It really depends on the fact that you have a set of wealthy Jews that are very much connected to the media and other, very, very top level institutions of the society. That's where Jewish influence comes from. I don't see that changing. I do see a tendency for Jews to abandon Europe. They are leaving certain areas of Europe, as you say, Sweden, France. But on the other hand, they seem to be coming into Germany.
Yeah.
So there's a sort of mixed picture there. But at the same time, I don't think it's going to really change Jewish power and influence. I've yet to see any evidence of that.
Right. Yeah. What do you think is the strategy here? I believe we talked a little bit about this, but it's a point that I think we need to reemphasize and look at what the issue is here in terms of Europe, because I remember reading a while back here about how the Arab the gates to certain cities in Europe, I think it's primarily from the Visigoth Empire and some of these, that they were opened up. I forget the king's name, if it was Roderick or something like that. They opened up the gates to the Arab invasion and managed to topple the Visigothic Empire in this way. And it seems to be that there were Jewish people behind that. It seems to be quite open in that regard. Are we seeing a kind of a mirror in history here, do you think, that we have an opening of the gates of mass immigration into Europe? And what's the core issue there, do you think? Is it to create conditions of conflict to try to erode away Western society and create... Because at the same time, if we follow through on that line of thinking... This is probably going to kind of harden the European population as well, correct? This is going to create something, potentially a reaction, which perhaps they're not thinking about, or is that part of it? How much strategy are we talking about here in the bigger picture, do you think, Kevin?
Well, I do think that Jewish support for this mass immigration from non-whites is strategic. That is, I think they realize, especially after World War II and the whole National Socialism movement, that in Germany the working class, the white working class, ended up voting for Hitler and all of that, and they took that to imply that they really can't expect to make an alliance with the white working class. If you look at Jewish political activity in the first 50 years of or 75 years of the 20th century, it was very much directed at the left, of trade unions and trying to form these alliances to topple, the white power structure based on basically working class. But after that, they decided, immigration was a far better way and produced this ethnic conflict and to actually end or greatly diminish white power. And so that's what we're seeing here. There's this long historical animosity between Jews and Western culture. They have a big chip on their shoulder because of how they construe the historical past. The past as involving anti-Semitism, pogroms, and so on, culminating in the Holocaust. So that's how they see Western culture. They don't see it as the culture that's enlightened and democracy and freedom and all. Anti-slavery and all that kind of stuff, that they see it as oppressive and hostile towards Jews. So they have engaged in this strategy for that reason. But it certainly has some risks. And one of the risks is bringing all these Muslims into Europe and the United States, provoking backlash, nationalistic backlash. And in the end, we are seeing more identification. We're seeing the rise of anti-immigration parties in Europe. Not so much in the United States, but there's feelings, popular attitudes against immigration in the United States, but it is not politically harnessed very well, although it does seem to be emerging as an issue in the 2014 elections within the Republican Party, especially, there's a great deal of anxiety about this very highly publicized invasion from Central America, where all these young people and just came up and walked over the border, and then the United States government just shipped them off to various places in the United States, essentially giving them sanctuary and amnesty. So that's becoming an issue, and I think it's a big issue in Europe, and it's going to grow, and that's the biggest hope I think we have for the future.
Now, it was a really good piece in your latest Occidental Quarterly I received here today on the right of association. And the issue, that I'm raising here is, which I think is a misconception, is that this is somehow kind of rooted in a hatred for others or whatnot. I think it's very important to clarify that this is trying to describe that the conditions that forced, ethnic diversity creates are... These begin to erode civic society. There are a lot of studies that have been done in terms of how more people are prone to, for example, stay at home than to go outside. Studies on children shows that they're more isolated when they actually end up playing and all this stuff. So it's very, a lot of this is known out there, the reality of the situation. But despite all this, nothing changes. It's like, the science says one thing, and it says that it actually creates difficult conditions for everybody, and especially for children as well. And I think that people would respond to that and say, okay, if that's what's going on, let's try to do something different about it. But what do you think is at the heart of the matter there, of why the science of some of these studies can't reach through there And is it a media question again? Is it a popularity? I mean, I think a lot of this has to do with culture ultimately, that it's a dialogue that is being pushed forward in popular culture, really. And there, that is why people still continue to believe it. Or what would you say is the root of that?
I agree entirely with that. I think that if someone like you or I had control of the mainstream big media in the United States and Sweden and Europe and so on, things would change very quickly. I mean, we get a constant drumbeat from the media that, historical white society is evil, racist, bad. We get a never-ending supply of movies on slavery in the South. That is the entire picture of our culture. There have been just dozens of Holocaust movies. This is the message that white people get over and over again. But what the science shows is that that there are very large downsides to this multiculturalism. And in that article, Christopher Donovan does a great job of summarizing a lot of the scientific research, that there are downsides. People become politically alienated. They don't want to contribute to the community anymore, to public goods, to like healthcare, if they think that the recipients of that healthcare are going to be people unlike themselves. All the socialized medicine that was so common that appeared in Europe in the 1960s and 50s and 70s and so on, all of that happened when these European societies were homogeneous.
Yeah.
When you have a society that has these deep ethnic differences, well, people, especially in the wealthier group, are not going to want to contribute to these public goods of these people that are way unlike themselves. So in America, the average white person, when they think about public health, they think, well, these black people are going to be benefiting and they're not going to be paying very much in taxes. I'm going to be paying taxes and I'm going to have to stand in line with these other people. I mean, it's not a good deal for them. And so they don't want to do it. But that's just one example. And so Christopher Donovan in Occidental Quarterly, in the summer issue, which is online, reviews quite a bit of this literature. And he's by training, he's an attorney. And so his article is focusing quite a bit on the legal issues. But what's happened is that the Supreme Court and the American legal system has essentially refused the right of association. And that's what I'm saying. Within Israel, this recent Supreme Court ruling essentially trumpets the right of association, that people have the right to exclude others from their community. That's something that is completely missing because of the revolution in law that happened in the last 50, 60 years. This is part of the triumph of the left.
Yeah, it's interesting. Now, how do you think the overall strategy there is viewed? I mean, is it just that the mainstream would call this, it's just prejudice, because we're all the same, right? So we just kind of need to get over this little hurdle. This is a bump of a reaction that, potentially might be rooted in human nature, really, or biology even. But at the same time, I think that they're trying to overcome those differences, that it's almost like it will just take a couple of these older generations to kind of die out, and then it will be much better in 2-3 generations. So it's kind of like a view, let's sacrifice them, but when these kids grow up that we've been able to mold as we see that, it will be all fine. Now, do you think that is a reasonable reality, or do you think that there is still going to be, I mean, if this is rooted in biology, that's going to be much more difficult to change these association preferences? It's just something that is part of our makeup, and it doesn't mean we're evil or good or anything like that. It's just something that we have to deal with because it's part of the natural laws, if you will. What's your take on that, Kevin?
Yeah, it's been a sort of constant theme of the left that we have to change people. I mean, if you look at the Soviet Union, we have to have this new Soviet man, and it didn't matter if we killed 10 million Russians to do so. In other words, we have the idea that we can mold this person, we can create this person, we just have the proper culture. No concern for biological realities, tendencies, and so on. And that's what we're trying to do here. We're trying to overcome human nature. We're trying to hope that culture can completely suppress all these natural tendencies, at least in white people. There doesn't seem to be any tendency to try to suppress those tendencies in non-whites. I mean, actually, ethnocentrism is encouraging non-whites.
Definitely.
Look at Jewish groups. there's all these programs to encourage ethnocentrism among Jews. You have all these black activist organizations encouraging people to, you know, be black and to think black and to have black identity and all that. But it's really directed against white people. So that's what the left has been doing for decades, and this is no different. And they're very hopeful because one of the things they always mention is that young people are more on their side. But what you see is that as people get older, I don't think it's going to change. As people start having families, as they start trying to find a school for their children, their attitudes start changing, and they do want to live in a more homogeneous society. They want to live in an area with good schools, and so on. And so they start to, you know, move and try to find a community that's more like themselves. But you have to realize that these young people are subjected to just incessant propaganda from the time they start going to school till the time they graduate college. They are given just wall-to-wall propaganda on issues related to race and ethnicity. And we look at the popular media, you know, the popular music, all the movies, everything else. So these people really don't know much of anything else, and they gradually start, I think, finding their way. And it's also interesting that in the 2012 presidential election, even the youngest age group, 18 to 29, voted Republican in America. So this attitude that we have to sort of stop this, and we have to, you know, this identification with the more traditional conservative aspects of American culture is going on with white people of all age classes and both sexes. It's weaker among women, it's weaker among the younger group, but even a majority of all age groups in both sexes are now voting, they're voting Republican, even though the Republican Party does nothing to help them economically. They're doing it because they identify as a white person.
Which is a shame too, of course, because it's obviously a controlled opposition. We have the New York intellectuals completely taking over that party and turning it into the neocons, neoconservatives, and you know, pro-Israel. It's run by AIPAC. It's not America's interest that is at heart there. So this is, of course, creating a lot of problems. But as you say, there's really, at this stage, despite everything, there's still not any viable options in America that is on the map that people actually can vote for, right?
That's the reality. I mean, things are much better in Europe. I often say that if there's going to be a revolution, it's going to start in Europe, because America, you have this two-party system. It's just almost impossible to break into it. You need huge money, really billions of dollars on your side, and really to get into the media, to really get your message across. Start forming political action committees in various cities and states. It's just a totally uphill thing. And of course, you know, every election basically have two parties. You can't break into it. So Europe, much better in all of the European countries I'm aware of. You have a pretty viable nationalist alternative, and that in general, these parties are gaining ground. So if there's going to be any optimism, that's where it has to come from.
Yeah, I want to ask you a bit more later about Swedish Democrats and things like that. And we had an election recently. I also want to ask you a little bit more about pop culture and Hollywood as a big part of this. But before we do that, this diversity fantasy that we were talking about here is obviously a massive and really costly experiment that they're trying to work against something that potentially, as the science seems to indicate, it's hard-coded in us. But at the same time, they're trying to force this upon people, as you say. And it's, I mean, look at where the resources is going in our world today and what is actually happening. I mean, we in America, there's hardly a space program anymore. But at the same time, NASA is spending millions on a Muslim outreach program. I mean, these are just one example, of course, but this is kind of reflective of the insanity that the more issues this creates, the more money they're going to need to pour into it, the more attention and focus and energy and all these combined efforts of things that we could spend on other things in trying to, you know, go forward in technology and science and everything. It seems like that is kind of beginning to fall short, and we're seeing kind of a crumbling of the very fabric of society in the Western world right now. It's horrible to see this going on, Kevin.
It is horrible, and that's a good example with the NASA program. I think we have to remember that the people who, the real activists are doing this, are motivated not by love for humanity, not by love for America or anything else. They are motivated by hatred towards the traditional people and culture of America. They're motivated by hatred towards the traditional people and culture of the European countries, as especially apparent, by the way, in England or the UK, where just hostility towards the old social mores of England. It was just so obvious in the Labour Party and other people on the left. Now those people are dominating. The Labour Party may well form the next government. They want more and more immigration. And quite a few of the people, they've emphasized that their motive in wanting this immigration is to swamp the conservatives, to just destroy the traditional culture of Europe, of England. And it's just motivated by hatred. Any revolution motivated by hatred, you have to really worry about what the long-term consequences of that are going to be.
Yeah.
Especially when we have, you know, examples like the gulags in Russia, the mass murder that happened. You know, ethnic conflict is the one constant of human history, and it's not going to stop just because these leftists are in power. They're motivated by hatred. They don't really care. I don't think that the establishment left cared that much about all these girls in Rotherham and England. They don't care about the huge imbalances in black-white crime. You know, blacks, murder whites like 10 times the reverse, even though blacks are a small minority in the population. And all the other crimes by blacks against whites, they don't really care about that. You know, it's because they have a hatred towards the traditional people and culture of America.
Yep. Now, let me ask you a little bit more here. A number of things, of course, I want to kind of go into here a little bit later. We're going to take a break in a while here, but I wanted to ask you what you think about the elections there in Sweden, because obviously now we're going to have a social democratic kind of, they're going to form government basically with a couple of others, probably the Greens and I forget the other party there. But basically on both sides of the political spectrum, the moderate so-called conservatives, but from an American perspective, they're very much left still. We really don't have that political spectrum in Sweden. But nonetheless, they've refused to work together with the Swedish Democrats. It's just unbelievable, the shunning of this party. They have a number of these small little things where, for example, you know, the head of the spokesperson, we're going to greet the party, the leaders of each party, but they, for example, refused to shake hand with Jimmy Åkesson, the leader of the Swedish Democrats, etc. So they're very clear, despite being, they got 12.9% of the votes, so almost 13%, which is quite a many Swedes, you know. And the fact is that they've decided, despite, you know, preaching tolerance, despite preaching, you know, an open society, this has been a democratic election. It's been done in this way, but they're ready to turn their back on these 13% of the Swedish population because they have the wrong opinion, right? And this is just something which is going to be further kind of work as a wedge issue, I believe, where so many politicians are going to work in reaction to whatever the Swedish Democrats do. The other party won't be able to, you know, talk about that issue or do something with it, which is quite interesting, because that means that if there's play their cards right, that means that they can actually begin to control the debate more or less if they're strategists like this. Of course, there is issues with the Swedish Democrats and their blanket support for Israel and all these kinds of issues, but at least it's kind of, it's an inclination of something in a certain direction where the, you know, you have a party rising up that are going against one of the main tenets of the establishment. So I don't know how much you've been viewing this, Kevin, but do you have any comments on what we're seeing here in Europe overall, I guess?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a very interesting phenomenon. I mean, it's horrifying, really, that these parties will try to completely exclude the Sweden Democrats. I was reading something today that the Sweden Democrats are still hopeful that they can be a kingmaker in certain areas. I mean, they were talking about the budget. If they were to team up with the moderate conservative, they could probably vote down a budget that were brought up by the liberals. But it's very interesting to compare Norway and Sweden, and I really don't know a whole lot about all that. But it's interesting that in Sweden you do have participation in the government of a party that is very critical of immigration, and it's had a big effect on Sweden's immigration policy. That party holds, I think, 19%, and it's a sort of libertarian party, but they have, you know, strongly criticized immigration and are having some influence. And I think the big difference is if you let a party like that into the government, they could have some say. And I would hope, you know, you would think that the moderate conservatives would be willing to make an alliance with the Sweden Democrats to have a majority and start to moderate immigration a little bit, at least, to appease the Sweden, you know, to go in the direction of Sweden Democrats in order to retain power. It's astonishing to me that they won't do that.
Yeah, definitely. It's I hope the socialist government in place now is not going to be the final nail in the coffin in terms of Sweden as well, because I think they said there, if something doesn't change in the terms of the migration policy and everything else, I think the Swedish Migration Board needs a drastic budget increase. I think it was speculated here almost 7 billion American dollars to cover the soaring costs in the next few years. And we had over speculated here, if the continuation of the laws is in place, you have over a 5-year period about 1 million immigrants going to come into Sweden. That's about 1/8, not quite, but 1/8 of the population increase in five years. And already, Kevin, we're in a situation where the people who are coming in are basically, we can't house them anywhere. There's no room. There's not even room for Swedes to get new apartments. Hardly. It's a complete lack of all these issues. And at the same time, it's like a mental disease that can't see through the reality that this does not work. We have, you know, youth unemployment digits in the double digits, and we have specifically among the immigration population, there's no jobs. Nothing is happening. We're letting in people, and we're not creating a better, you know, life for them. Really, you know, it's insanity. You know,
it's like immigration and diversity are ends in themselves, no matter what the cost to society. It is like a moral imperative that simply has to be followed, it's absolutely destructive. And of course, the other thing is that all of these European countries, where you have one party that is more in favor of immigration than any other party, like in the UK, it's Labour Party and so on. And these parties are actually gaining votes, of course, by admitting that. And in America, you've got the Democratic Party, and they're more in favor of immigration generally than the Republican Party. And so they're gaining votes. So there's a huge, incentive there. But I think Sweden just amazes me, because it seems that there's this stifling moral political correctness there where people don't feel they can dissent from this. You try to wrap your mind around it, but it is truly remarkable that all these costs that are apparent to anyone, you know, $7 billion is no small amount of money for a country like Sweden.
No.
And all the social disorganization, the rape statistics, the unemployment, the lack of learning Swedish, the sort of aggressive Muslim, you know, we're going to have Sharia law and all that. It's just astonishing that this continues.
Yeah, I know. It's. I think it's going to be a grim reality that some of these people are going to wake up to one day and realize what is happening. I mean, I'm not against helping other, people. That's not what this is about either. I think it just exemplifies the insanity of Scandinavia and the idea that you're on behalf of others, you try to grant something to other. I mean, Sweden grants blanket asylum to Syrian refugees, for example. And whoever applies, they can get in, you know. And it's like, and the Kurdish population as well, I think that's great. Sweden has been very welcoming in helping out these people and everything like that. But of course, what I'm hoping for is that one day they can return to their own homeland. I think that they would miss it. They would want to be there. But these are all reflections in the long run, Kevin, at least of the asylum seekers that are fleeing from war and internal strife and everything else, is issues that have been, to a certain extent, encouraged and started by organizations like AIPAC, who's running American foreign policy, the hunt for, you know, ISIS and all these terrorist organizations and everything else, a lot of people have a lot of question marks here, of course, of who's pulling the strings behind the scenes. So I think that beyond fulfilling the objective of trying to just completely militarily controlling the Middle East, you get a secondary objective, which is, of course, to drive a lot of these populations into Europe and the Western world, correct?
That's quite right. I think when America attacked Iraq, it just completely unsettled the Middle East. And we're still seeing huge repercussions from that today. I mean, it boggles the mind to think that every last Syrian could now go to Sweden if they wanted to. I mean, it's remarkable. One of the things that happens in Norway is that they're very much declaring their sympathy, but they're saying that we should help people where they are rather than bring them to Norway. But Sweden can't even seem to advocate that. Do they really think they can absorb? I think the population of Syria is 25 million or something like that. It's just impossible for Sweden to do this. But these people don't. It's like practicality is not an issue. This is a moral imperative, and by God, they're going to continue to do it, I guess.
Yeah, well, this is what the Sweden Democrats have been talking about. They have said, let's help people in place where they are. I mean, even the asylum industry, as they're calling it in Sweden, where a lot of people are actually making a lot of money on it because it's such a boon to certain industries. For example, those who have a little bit of property and trailer parks and renting out spaces to people, they're getting a lot of government money, including lawyers, for example, that ends up handling these cases. But they're getting paid by the government. So it's this is all coming from the government coffers by the people themselves. And the bottom line here as well is that in the world, a lot of these people coming to Sweden, they're a majority. We are the minority. But in this case, I guess we're not worth, preserving or protecting in this regard, right? It's just the double standards,
I wrote an article recently on how immigration and refugee policy is incentivized in America. I mean, it's the same thing there. You have these organizations, especially these Lutherans, Jewish organizations and so on. They get hugely subsidized by the federal government to bring in refugees. So they hunt down refugees, because it's in their financial interest to do so. And sometimes in their ideological, quite often in their ideological interest, that's just the way they are. But it extends to attorneys. It extends to all these groups that form companies that then produce, these seminars on diversity issues and how to affirmative action and all that kind of stuff. So there's just a big bureaucracy of people. Huge numbers of people are employed in this industry. And if you look at the academic world, you have whole departments that are, geared towards diversity issues. You have Department of, Asian studies and Jewish studies and Hispanic studies and everything else. They're all funded, all government supported. And so there's just billions and billions of dollars that are given towards this industry. And people have huge self-interest. And quite a few, just regular white people see this and they just go for it. They don't care about the big picture or whether Sweden or the United States is falling apart as a result of this. They see, big salaries, big money, and they go for it.
Yeah, they do. Now, we're going to take a short break here in a little bit. I'm going to continue and pick up with the next segment here after a break. I want to get into Rotherham, Hollywood influence overall, and also the rise of, European culture. What can be done there to instigate an interest there to begin to fall onto the map? And also, I want to get your take on the Scottish independence referendum, Kevin. But tell us about your websites here first. I want to hear about the Occidental Quarterly as well, as you mentioned before. And of course, where people can pick up a copy of your magnum opus there, The Culture of Critique.
Yeah, I have three websites that I'm associated with. The Actual Observer is a sort of blog site, shorter articles in general. It's www.theactionalobserver.net. And then The Occidental Quarterly is a sort of academic journal that we put out quarterly. And that is actionalquarterly.com. You can subscribe to that either electronically or with a hard copy version. And then I also have my own website, kevinmcdonald.net, where I have information about my books and so on.
All right, very good. A lot of stuff to check out there. And do check out the Occidental Quarterly. Very good publications, some very interesting and well-researched articles coming out of there as well. We'll have the link up on the website, but we'll take a short break. Stay with us, Kevin. We'll be right back.